Oh, again, and welcome to True Wealth, your tangible assets advisor. This is your host, Kevin Walter, coming to you from the Clock Tower building on Division inside the in the recording studio. Coins Plus sponsors the show True Wealth, always has and always will. Coins Plus is located at the same location, 3201 North Division Street, and can be reached at 444-0044 if you're calling from Spokane. If you're calling outside the area, toll free, it's 877-TAP-COIN, 877-827-2646, or of course through the website coinsplus.com, where we'll try to get back to you as soon as we can. We do our best on that, but if you want immediate help, give us a call, and we'll be happy to, you know, do what we can to help you out. Coins Plus has been in business over a couple decades. We're a full-service rare coin and precious metals broker-dealer depository service. We buy and sell all forms of precious metals, coins, collections. We deal in scrap gold, jewelry, and diamonds. We strive to be, well, our motto is honesty, integrity, and professionalism in all, in every transaction. And we've been here a while. We've established a solid reputation. It's important to us. One of our key components of who we are and part of the reason for the show is we like to help people with what we call wealth and capital preservation. That's essentially portfolio building. It's accumulating wealth, establishing assets. I spoke a little bit in the last show about the fact that hard assets are specifically what last, that Christ himself said that he entrusted himself to no man, for he knew what was on man's heart, that we literally have been brainwashed to think that handing our money over to somebody is somehow a form of security. We have seen rampant robbery from like the Bernie Madoffs and AIG and just mammoth collapses of these types of organizations that have literally confiscated the wealth of so many Americans. The 08, 09 quote-unquote financial collapse, which was an absolute tragedy, is a very fine example of what we're up against. But the truth of the matter is, you know, the way I see that financial collapse, 08, 09, was a pulling back of the veil, just giving you a glimpse of what's behind the scenes and allowing banks and the government to all maneuver. It allowed the banks to absolutely fleece people of their wealth. It allowed the government to, you know, provide extraordinary bailouts to the banks. It allowed a lot of people to get away with a lot of unruly behavior that was essentially already building. It allowed a whole bunch of people to get off of not paying for mammoth amounts of derivatives, where they had let basically major sectors of the financial industry bet against the market. It covered for, or bet against the entire economy, I should say. The collapse allowed a cover for people who had literally cooked the books on mortgages at a level that's unfathomable. Some people may not understand that. I spent years in that business. There's a few movies that have been out to kind of describe this stuff. One was called The Big Short, which showed the backside of what was going on behind the scenes. There's 99 Homes. These movies are all a couple years old that showed the front side of what was going on behind the scenes. And the mortgage industry became a massive Ponzi scheme of money moving all around so everyone could get a piece of the action. When the dust settled, the real loser was you, the consumer. And you think about it, you have people that lost their jobs, lost their homes, and all that stuff. But on top of it all, what happened was there was this big roundabout, you know, taxation. That's what this Keynesian economic system is always about. It's about a hidden taxation. So what they do is they did the 21st bailout in the history of this nation since the construction of the Federal Reserve Act in 1913. And so they provide these massive bailouts. They get George Bush to come forward and look you know, like a deer in the headlights and say, look, I'm a free market guy, but they're telling me if I don't do this, the entire economy is going to collapse. They're telling him that the whole global economy will collapse as a result. And he, according to his words, is doing it only because the quote-unquote experts have told him that that's what he's got to do, that he has no other choice. And he authorizes the 21st bailout in the history of this nation since the Federal Reserve. What else it did was it propelled the socialistic rampant inflationary spending that Obama never stopped. So Obama was the preferred candidate that everybody loved, and you know, and he got involved in the economics of everything, and you know, he was consulting George Bush, and he of course wanted the bailout to be done, the TARP funding and all that. And the crazy thing about it is he totally issued it and encouraged it to be issued. And even George Bush said, you know, my most likely predecessor, Barack Hussein Obama, wants this. And so I'm doing it primarily because the experts are telling me, and primarily because he's coming into office behind me. And therefore, I'm going to issue this bailout. The problem with it was, one problem that continued with Obama was he started the spending never stopped. It made him look like when he got in office, there was a far higher deficit than there really was. The deficit when he got into office appeared to be in the upper 9 trillion range, but really it was under 5. And what I mean by that is they had just issued this massive bailout under the direction of Ben Bernanke and Hank Paulson. They just issued this with Bush as president, not knowing how vitriolically destructive Obama's tongue would be, just, you know, lacerating George Bush every day he was in office, blaming him for everything, making it appear that the deficit went from 10 trillion to 21 trillion under his range. Or rain, I should say, or to 20 trillion, so a 10 trillion increase under Obama, which makes it look like he only spent 1.25 trillion a year, which is not an only, but on top of that, the real fact was it went from about 5 trillion to 20 trillion, counting that first big bailout, which is more like, what, 2 trillion a year. Again, the numbers are so substantial, who knows the difference, right? But it is a difference because it's absolutely set a new level of economic acceleration as has never been seen before, thought before, imagined before. You know, just absolutely, we're on this train, and we become so accustomed to this stuff. That's probably the number one thing that I find myself doing, even individually, is accepting everything. Now, some people you talk to about this stuff, and they get all emotional and they get all shook up. I mean, bottom line, folks, you know, biblically, if we're Christians, we've got to be sober-minded. We've got to have self-control. We've got to exhibit the fruits of the Spirit. So there's a passion that is represented by Christ in the Bible. And there's also a form of anger that's legitimate. And I call it righteous indignation. Jesus got angry. Jesus flipped over tables, but he didn't just rampage at random. So when people say, oh, you know, when you're a Christian, you shouldn't have anger, that's not true. The anger needs to be appropriate and relevant. And I think when we look at what's happened, if we really love this country, which is becoming not harder to love America, but harder to love what the people are doing to America and the transformations that are taking place, and we're allowing so many of these immigrants and people to pour into this country that hate us. I mean, folks, we have no criteria for entry into this nation, and we are literally on a daily basis with this mindset of freedom of speech, we are allowing people to come into this country that will openly tell you that they stand against it in every possible way. My primary example is the Islamic religion, Muslims. I mean, folks, you know, one thing I'm tired of, and it's probably very politically incorrect, but it is a lie. The religion is a lie. The religion is the devil's religion. It is a dark religion. It is a religion that absolutely mandates jihad, you know, murder, decapitation, torture. It is terrifically vicious, to put it lightly. I mean, it is what it is. They have no business with that religion in a freedom of religion nation. Their religion forbids our freedom of religion. It demands a theocracy. When a religion demands, keyword, a theocracy through violence and force and, you know, no holds barred, folks, they don't belong here. So they have a couple different types of jihad, okay? One is literally part of their jihad is if you can't beat them militarily, you beat them through population influx. This is a doctrine of the Quran, of one of the hadiths or whatever. The other doctrine that they are commanded to live by is taqiyya. Taqiyya is an absolute divine command to deceive and lie and cheat. This is the truth. I'm not making it up. It is in the Quran, crystal clear. Do your research. Just use Google. I mean, it's not that hard. It's there, okay? They have got to lie, cheat, and steal to get the job done. And we, our entire involvement in the Middle East is all based on the premise of taqiyya. We've been lied to, deceived, to be drug over there. Even the deposal of Saddam Hussein. I mean, we have been lied to and deceived. Now, granted, people say, oh, gosh, that was so long ago. Yeah, it's so long ago that it has everything to do with what we're doing here today, what we're talking about. You go 9/11, which is a pre-planned, orchestrated event, and, you know, there were a variety of variables that checked into that. You had the People for a New American Century, which was Cheney and Rumsfeld and all these guys. They developed this society that basically wanted a modern-day Pearl Harbor, that they said it, that that's what they needed in order to impose this police state that they wanted. They wanted more surveillance and more control over the people, directly in contradiction to everything America had stood for forever. Well, the elite school systems, colleges, universities, and things, they know better than you and I, so they decide that these things are mandatory. Okay, so you got People for a New American Century that basically have Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney in very critical spots in our government. So they have access to huge amounts of money. And what I've mentioned before is September 10th of 2001. Now, remember, September 11th was the big day. September 10th of 2001, the day before 9/11, at 3 p.m. in the afternoon, Donald Rumsfeld gives his little emergency speech to Congress and says, we've lost $2.3 trillion in the Department of Defense. We don't know where it is or how, whatever. We're going to look for it. Well, there's only a couple locations where they were going to look for it. World Trade Center Building Number 7, which was the one that went down, whatever it was, 8 or 10 hours after Trade Towers 1 and 2 went down. It had sustained no damage. It was the building that not only held all the record keeping for the Pentagon and everywhere else, but also for the IRS, FBI, and SEC. So combined, they created an event that destroyed all the records of over 100 major corporations being under investigation for cooking the books on Wall Street in the exact same way Enron had done, where they were just, it was, you know, like I've mentioned, Arthur Andreessen, the largest accounting firm in the world, 260,000 employees went under because it was proven that they were intentionally cooking the books of Enron. They were making so much money doing it that they literally had thrown aside all of their morals and ethics. I mean, think about the brevity of that. The significance. A company with 260,000 employees globally becomes so entrenched and ingrained in deception that they literally risk everything. This is an accounting firm. And folks, I've spent a few years in business and banking and numbers, and accounting is a serious trade. It's a serious business. The numbers are hard and fast and non-negotiable. They are what they are. Typically, your accountant is the guy that's always going to tell you to take the safe road. They're going to tell you to do the right thing. They're the ones that won't compromise and won't step over the line. They might give you little hints on what you can do, but they'll tell you maybe about the gray area. But in my experience, they'll never encourage you to go to the gray area. They know that you have free will and can make that choice. They made the choice to literally deceive America. The largest Fortune number one company in the world, Enron, was all phony. It took everyone down for so much money. Well, that was one of over 100 more waiting to blow. All this stuff had been created by the dot-com craze, the casino frenzy market of the late 90s. When, you know, the stock market was booming, we had the dot-com craze, we had the NASDAQ roaring, we had money coming in from overseas, life was good, Bill Clinton was in office, you know, and it's about the economy, stupid. And that was their catchphrase. And, you know, everything was supposed to be so wonderful. And they knew it wasn't. Companies don't grow 10% a year, folks. And what's really crazy is everybody's wanting those days back. They want to renew that profit. They want to renew those days. Those days, the dot-com craze, only lasted a couple years. But people remember it romantically as if it was a prolonged period of time. And it wasn't. It was just a couple short years. And it's important to understand that, because when we're trying to get back to that, we need to realize that on average, as a whole, America, or the stock market in America, I had something on my screen in front of me. The stock market in America has really failed people in general. And it's sad. So what I was getting at was the whole 9/11 event, you know, that led to Iraq and the deposal of Saddam absolutely embedded us in the Middle East at a level that's mind-boggling. Even to the point when Obama ran, he got over $500 million improperly recorded because the computer system wasn't working properly, according to the Obama campaign. Over $500 million from a solicitation center in Gaza. From who? From hardcore terrorists. This is why Obama got on a plane right after his inauguration. And where did he go very first? Saudi Arabia, the most powerful Arab nation in the world, possibly one of the most powerful men in the world when it comes down to real power, the power over man, you know, on earth. He went to the king of Saudi Arabia. It's Salman Assad or whatever his name was. I met his son, who's now the crown prince. And he bowed below the navel of King Salam al-Saad at the time. To bow below the navel in that nation is to show not respect, but in complete submissive inferiority. Like a servant who is in trouble will bow below the navel. Somebody who's about to be tried for execution, for a capital crime, will bow below the navel in begging for mercy. Obama bowed below the navel of this man. His very first trip, very, very first trip right out of the box. Because he had gotten such a substantial amount of support and assistance monetarily and in what other means, we don't know. I think there's an old Chinese proverb, probably from Confucius, that says, to a thief, everyone's a thief. And I personally believe that all these attacks on Trump about Russian collusion coming from the upper echelon of the Democratic Party is partially due to the fact that they're on a permanent smear campaign at the absolute detriment of America. They have no concern for the populace, the citizenry. They could care less about the constituency. They just want power, okay? That's their number one drive. Their number two drive, or maybe we'll flip-flop it. They'll say that's their number two drive, is just to win at any cost to maintain power. But what's really behind a lot of these accusations against Trump is probably the belief, the sincere belief, that there was corruption and collusion. Why? Because to a thief, everyone's a thief. Remember that. If somebody's paranoid and they keep accusing you of doing stuff to them, that's not true, folks. Keyword, not true. If you're doing something to somebody or you're being shifty and underhanded and they're calling you out on it, take responsibility. But if they're just falsely accusing you, one of the commandments, right, over and over, this is telling you what's in man's heart. This is telling you what's in their heart. People that cannot trust you, that just cannot trust you, can't be trusted. Now, there's wisdom and common skepticism. I mean, obviously in this business over the years, we've handled over $1 billion worth of material over decades. And people bring stuff in and we have to handle it and touch it and feel it and look at it. And sometimes we go in the back room and, you know, we work on it and or people mail us stuff. And, you know, there's times people drop stuff off and get a check later and there's everything. But trust is paramount. Occasionally, you will get somebody that is so paranoid, so convinced that they cannot trust a company of our caliber, you know, decades of experience, a very, very impeccable reputation, and they're just certain that given any opportunity you'll steal, those people are telling you so much about themselves. They can't be trusted. They can't even fathom how you could be trusted. Now, I'm not telling you, again, not to be skeptical and wise and not foolish. But folks, we've got discernment. If you're a believer in Christ and you got the Holy Spirit, you got discernment. You know, you need to learn to live by the Spirit, not by your emotions. This is what's hard for people. You've got, to most people, it goes intellect, emotion, spirit. The way it should be, the way you should function in life is spirit, intellect, emotion. The spirit should come first. Some people say, oh, I get a gut, okay? If someone who doesn't live by faith says they got a gut, what they're telling you is they're having an emotional response, okay? Or they may be using their common sense and logic and just calling it a gut. If you're living by the spirit, you have discernment. If the Bible's true, and I believe it is, and it says that you receive the Holy Spirit, that the Holy Spirit dwells within you, and the Holy Spirit's interconnected with other believers, don't you think that that Spirit of God might be sending you messages, might be judging and perceiving, and don't you think that you can tap into that, what they call in the Bible, the still small voice within? So many people want God to speak to them with a blowhorn in their ear. Good luck with that. He speaks to us through our inner core. He speaks from the inside out. And we need to learn to listen to that. If we can learn to listen to that, we don't need to be paranoid. I'm not saying you won't make mistakes, because guess what? God will allow you to make mistakes. God will put you in situations to make decisions. But I guarantee you, when people think that you can actually achieve perfection on earth, that, I mean, I, you might sit there and go, what are you talking about? I literally know of people whose theology believes that they can achieve perfection on earth. And I'm not talking wacky cults. I'm talking, you know, like Free Methodists that believe in, you know, you've got Calvinism and Arminianism or whatever it is. And, you know, they've got these theories. And there's no way God would even allow that. Not that he, I mean, and I don't mean that in the wrong way, but we're constantly being tested. We're constantly going to fail. We're going to make mistakes. We need to be challenged. Any believer that thinks they're perfect, that thinks they're super, super close, has a extremely skewed perspective of who they are. So you will make mistakes even if you live by the Spirit. But the point is, that's the kind of discernment we need. And even on a grand scale, I mean, everything we do, we need discernment. So that was my little 911 tangent. There's a few things that I kind of was bouncing around. I guess for the first thing we'll talk about is economics, okay? We've got, wow, there's a lot of different directions I can go with this. The first thing I want to talk about is the fact that they call the average per capita income in the United States of America is $25,000 a year. Over the last 40-ish years since we had the deregulation of metals and inflation took off, and we have had hyperinflation, literally triple. And in the same amount of time, our incomes have only gone up about 60, 70%. So while, you know, if you had what you could buy with $100, so let's just say back in 1974, you made $100 and your life cost $100 to live. What the 40-year inflationary figures I just explained do is this. So 40 years, you earned $100 and it took $100 to live. The $100 it took to live now takes about $325. The $100 you earned back then is now up to $160, $170. So what's happened simply is that wages have not increased proportionate to cost of living. Not even close. People lived better back then. They had disposable income. You know, granted, there's all kinds of debates. Well, there's so many more things to buy and this. But I mean, just based on the staples of life, food, transportation, real estate, and energy costs, which are where you spend 85% of your disposable income, which are the items which were primarily excluded from the consumer price index under the Clinton administration. And what I mean by that is that the CPI, the consumer price index, to calculate inflation has been around quite a while since the Federal Reserve Act shortly after, and it's supposed to calculate a mass of variable expenses on a year-to-year basis to determine what real inflation was. Well, it included historically the number one selling, you know, car, and the number one selling, say, dishwasher, and the, you know, the average price of a home, and the price of a gallon of gas, and, you know, all these things that are very standardized across the board, a boundary across the board. Under Clinton, he removed food, transportation, real estate, and energy costs, and I say primarily because he did leave little scattered crumbs of it throughout so that they can say, well, the entire sector hasn't been eliminated. It was just modified. Well, it was modified to pretty much remove 99% of it. The reason he did that is because under his reign, hyperinflation was beginning to roar pretty good during the dot-com craze. He was starting to produce some debt. We had money coming in from overseas. When we had the big bouncy ball of surplus going around, and what do we do with the money and the arguments between the right and the left, we literally got to a point where we had an influx of foreign money that literally could have bailed us out, paid off the Fed. The entire system implodes and explodes and crumbles if the Fed gets paid off. It's designed that the interest outruns the currency creation. We cannot pay it off. Now we're in a situation where it's physically impossible to ever pay it off. But at the time, we had such an influx of non-corrupted money, non-Federal Reserve-impacted money, real money that hadn't been influenced or laundered through the Federal Reserve, we could have paid the debt off. There's a good reason why they didn't do it, because you lose complete control. We would have had to go back to a gold and silver standard, and the world would have been a different place today. And there's all kinds, people argue all kinds of things with gold and silver. You can easily have credit cards or paper money. If everything was backed by hard assets, you'd have true wealth. It'd be a little bit like, you know, the phenomenon with the cyber currencies or whatever, where you buy them and then over time they go up. They're not designed to do that, but because of scarcity and supply and demand, they grow in value, you know. And again, you don't want to use them as a speculative investment, but that's because there's a fixed amount of money and a fixed number of people. And as the number of people change, increase, and the amount of wealth they're creating increases, it actually makes the money go up. So from the Coinage Act of 1792 in America until the inception of the Federal Reserve in 1917 or 1913, the value, the buying power of the dollar went up fivefold. Think about that. If you put a dollar away in 1792, or just say 1800, and your family pulled it out in 1900, they could get five times the buying power of 100 years earlier. Now that you might be like, well, that's not a very good return over 100 years. Well, how about over the last 100-ish years since the inception of the Fed, you've lost 99.5% of the buying power. So from 1792 till, well, again, let's keep it simple. From 1800 to 1900, what costs $100 in 17, what costs $100 in 1800 was only $20 in 1900. Okay. So let's go 1913 to 2013. The Fed was created in 1913. So what cost $100 in 1800 was down to $20 by 1900. That's the gold and silver. That's what it does. Now, what costs $100 in 1913, you're not even going to believe this number, cost $20,000 in 2013. You think I'm wrong? Go do the math. It's about a 200-fold increase. That's a 99.5% loss of spending power. That's true. That's hyperinflation. That's how bad it is. What costs $100 in 1913 takes $20,000 today. So that's the contrast, Keynesian economics versus hard assets. Now, you can actually, the gold standard's not dead. It's just not held by the government. You can establish your own gold standard. And what's interesting is, like a minute ago, I was talking about how the per capita incomes have declined so rapidly in America, people can't live. People really are at the poverty level. The poverty level continues to increase. The poverty line, what they consider anything below this amount, you're in poverty. That line grows because of inflation. The average income of the working class American lowers because of inflation and not being properly compensated to account for cost of living increases. And so over time, people are losing more and more and more spending power. Then what happens? Well, people can't live. So what do? Number one, debt. Now, debt's so easy to get in this day and age, it's beyond imagination. But what happens more is people become dependent on government programs. The government is doing this on purpose. It's a socialistic agenda. We are truly being infiltrated by hardcore socialism from the inside out. No mistakes, no misunderstandings. Absolutely intentional It's happening. Okay, this is happening. And what happens when they get people on the government dole? They become dependent and afraid. When you have no control over your income, and you're getting handouts from the government, all kinds of things go wrong. People lose self-esteem. They gain a sense of entitlement. Our government has got this absolute confusion over the separation of church and state. Absolute confusion that they have no right to dictate morality to anyone. So you can be literally dealing drugs. And, you know, going out and impregnating women and whatever you want to call it. You can be robbing houses and you can still get your welfare check. You know, and they encourage women not to get married. Don't have a man in the house. You'll lose your benefits. If they find out that a woman's got a man, they want to know his income. You're going to get married, now you combine your incomes. You no longer qualify for welfare. I'm not saying that welfare is a good thing. It is all designed to destroy America. As this becomes more prevalent, and as we live in an era where this stuff is taking over rampantly, and I mean, you know what I'm talking about. It's starting to cover every square inch of this nation. Now we begin to impose, the left begins to impose what from the Frankfurt School is called critical theory. Critical theory means it's to steal and kill and destroy. It's Saul Alinsky politics. It is destructive. Critical theory means just what it says, to be extremely critical, to criticize and condemn and never offer a solution and just keep spinning the condemnation, spinning the judgment, breaking the system down, not edifying, just to destroy the system from within. This is what you're seeing going on around us right now. Folks, I understand we're people of faith. I understand God is sovereign. God's omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent, okay? He's all-knowing, he's all-powerful, and he's all-present. But we have free will, and he lets us rule and reign by that. He lifts up rulers and puts them down and all this stuff. But I'm telling you, we are in a situation where he will allow us to do this stuff ourselves. So when you look at what has happened to the per capita income in America, the $25,000, people live paycheck to paycheck in America on average, okay? They just do. We hear stories of people waiting until midnight at the end of the month so accounts can get filled with funds just to go buy food, okay? This should not come as a shock considering the per capita income of a working American is roughly $25,000. That is nothing, okay? In this day and age, I can take a look basically what a budget looks like at this level, okay? Budgeting has, you know, it's interesting in our society. Budgeting has a negative connotation, doesn't it? People don't like that. You just spend what you get, right? It almost feels like it fits into the category of dieting or exercising when these things should be embraced. They should be good, but we lack self-discipline. We encourage impulsivity in America. It's apparent that budgeting is simply one of those things people choose to avoid or ignore when they probably would benefit if they took the time to do it. And this is something I learned long ago helping people financially. People just don't budget. So if you look at income data, you'll find that nearly half of individual workers make around $25,000 a year or less in reportable incomes. And so basically, about half of Americans are at $25,000 or below. That's a lot, right? I mean, that really is a lot. It's a huge portion of our country. You're talking 100 million workers in this country having reportable income of $25,000 a year or less. So it might be difficult to save for retirement or even buy a home when people can't even get by, okay? So say on $25,000 a year, here's a general idea of what people go through, you know. But on $25,000 a year, the taxes alone, even at that low of a level, you got Social Security and Medicare at 8.25%, federal income tax, I won't go through it all, state and local, whatever. So their after-tax income's $21,000. There goes $5,000. You go 50% of after-tax income, you know, to rent. I mean, that this leaves somebody the ability to pay $330 a month rent. You figure $88 utilities. I got this whole budget thing I figured out. I won't go through it all. 5% for groceries gives them $88 a month to live. You can't do that. You know, and then they've got all got credit cards. I put zero because they shouldn't have one. So basically the essentials of just getting by, transportation, car insurance, phone, cable, internet, you know, all that kind of stuff eats up another $10,500 a year. And that's at levels that I think are unsustainable. And then you get into the, I took 20% of the income for, you know, people's normal lives. You know, the average individual in America, average, everybody divided out has like if you count men, women, and children, it's $53 a month in student loan payments. If you reduce children and elderly and you end up, and then, you know, there's all kinds of ways to divide it out. But basically, anybody within a certain 25-year bandwidth of college graduation has an average student loan payment over $300 a month. So if you just average $50 a month, you say, well, someone on $25,000 a year didn't go to college. A lot of them did. They just didn't finish. It's a pretty sad situation. And as a side note, our education system's so screwed up. They spend 12 years of our life in public school preparing us for college. What they're doing is they're building a compost pile, okay? A compost pile is where you put all your trash together, and then you pack it down and you process it, and then the heat and bacteria begins to eat it up, and eventually you're going to end up with fertile soil, but it's destroying trash. So for 12 years, or it's, I should say it's fermenting trash. For 12 years, they're creating a compost pile in our brain. Why do I say this? Because once compost, ripens, I guess you'd call it, or comes to fermentation or fruition, it creates fertile soil that will pretty much take whatever you put in it and make it grow. So they literally are pumping trash into the minds of our children just as you would into a compost pile. And they're turning it and cultivating it, and they're getting it, and they're letting the bacteria and all the filth get in there and all the stench and all the garbage. So when our kids go to college, they've got this fertile mind that's ready to take anything that you can throw at it. And they begin to absorb. They're first away from their parent. They're often away from their parents for the very first time. They really aren't used to thinking on their own. College provides an atmosphere where a parentally dependent child can technically function if they live in the dorms and they've got the food card and everybody takes care of them. The problem is then they brainwash the child and prepare them for society. A four-year degree, folks, gives you a minimum of 2 years of rubbish, okay? What they call gen recs, general requirements, all this social science, what they call liberal arts, to make our kids more culturally sensitive, where you have to take, now they have immigrant studies in college is a class that's becoming very popular. And it's a brainwashing to help you understand and empathize with immigrants in this nation. Religious studies. Even when I was in college in the 80s, religious studies was absolute propaganda filth. You know, all the other religions are good. Christianity is bad. They call Christianity Catholicism. They compare when they evaluate Christianity, it's always Catholicism. Well, Catholicism is a man-made system. Catholicism is the epitome of religion. Religion is a man-made institution. It has nothing to do with spirituality. Catholicism is a large entity that happens to be in the business of, I guess you want to call it Christianity, it's pretty twisted up. But the fact of the matter is that they deceive. They do these comparatives. So 4-year degree, 2 years of junk, 2 years of mediocre, and you're out. And you basically have a general overview. You've been brainwashed and taught how to function in the system, which is what the system's all about. Kids come out of college naive. In a lot of them, if they get these lighter degrees, easy to get degrees like business or whatever, they really don't come out powerhouses. Some of them, if they get a harder degree, a harder education, may come out with an improved work ethic or commitment or dedication. But in general, they have these big student loans for all these garbage classes that are of no value to them. As a prime example, to just kind of put it into perspective, years back, we went to Sonoma Valley, where they have this big wine. You know, it's north of Napa Valley, big wine country. My wife and I, we built a house, very nice house. And as I was getting near the end of the home, I'm like, you know, this home is so nice that if I go to sell it to somebody that's going to want to pay good money for it, they may want a wine cellar. So at the last minute, I built a wine cellar only because I wanted everything in the house, if we sold it later, to be cater to anybody at that level and so on. So we decided to learn a little bit about wine. And so we went down to Sonoma Valley. We stayed at this place called the Farmhouse, which is this wonderful 5-star place that specializes in wine. There's people with wine degrees all over that valley, everywhere you go. But we met a gal from Australia who ran the whole farmhouse. And the name Farmhouse is deceptive. This place was unbelievable. She had a 4-year degree from Australia, but ran the whole place. I was talking to her. I'm like, why are you so much more knowledgeable? And why are you over these people who have more experience and education than you do? She said, in Australia, we go to 4 solid years of curriculum. So when I studied winology, it was 4 solid years, no junk classes, 4 solid years. Not only that, during those 4 solid years, we are required to be employed in the industry. So I worked for, you know, she said she worked for some wine, whatever you call it, great big vineyard or whatever they do. And she learned everything about wine after hours. She applied her school studies, etc. She came out of there a specialist, an expert. They have the same program in medicine. You can get a full medical degree in Australia in 5 years. In America, you can't even go to medical school till you finish your 4th year. Then you do 4 more years of medical school. And then, if you want to specialize, you do 2 to 4 more years. They're now seeing student loans. I have a friend who's in banking who said he saw for the first time a while ago a graduated doctor with over $1 million in student loans. He said most doctors, they're seeing $400,000 to $600,000 in student loan debt in these people's hands. So this is the direction America's gone. So needless to say, when I did the whole budget of what a person tries to live on the per capita income of $25,000, it can't happen, folks. It's utter poverty. They can't save. I mean, they can't save. They can't get by. The thing you can't even calculate for is emergencies, and it's just a tough way to go. You know, in the new retirement model revolves around dying broke and realizing the 401k model of investing is a sham for most Americans. I mean, just people don't have the money. They don't understand it. I spoke recently of my family saving, my parents saving 10% of their earnings for decades and decades and decades, and really ending with very little. Okay. And everybody's like, not me. I'm going to be in this special stock program. No, you're not. You're going to end up just like the rest of them. The big scam is all of it could go poof in a day. So, nutshell, assets. I've gone through the biblical reasoning. I've gone through the biblical logic, the biblical leading. You know, it's very clear that the things that are biblically attributed as true wealth are sectors: gold and silver, livestock, real estate, human life, precious stones. And I've explained it over and over. Gold and silver. in our business, that's a huge sector that encompasses coins and whatnot. We have got right now, I think I've mentioned, I've been cleaning out the vault to you. That may mean nothing to me. It's 20 years of interesting accumulation. I've constructed a barrage of really cool investment products, rolls of better, you know, Standing Liberty quarters, uncirculated silver nickels that they made during the war because they used the bronze for ammunition. Where, you know, there's the early Washington quarters in nice, decent condition from the 30s. And these kinds of things are running at about $20 an ounce, 20 times face. And, you know, with silver at 16 and change, it's not that bad. The upside's great. These coins are excruciatingly scarce. The potential collectability down the road is substantial. It's guaranteed. It's just, you know, how fast they'll go up, I can't say. But I know when the market heats up, they run hard. And you can buy these so close to their silver value. This is what we're putting into investment portfolios as our semi-numismatic sector. That's what we mean by semi-numismatic. When we build a portfolio, you get bullion, semi-numismatic, and numismatic. Bullion means it's just worth its intrinsic value. People always think bullion means it's a little gold cube. No, it's a coin. That way it can be recognized. Semi-numismatic are items that are either temporarily undervalued or just long-term undervalued, and they need to have a huge upside swing. They're basically items that you buy relative to their silver market. It reflects or it fluctuates based on the precious metals markets. But the coins that are encompassed in a semi-numismatic portion of a portfolio have tremendous upside based on market moves. And then we move into numismatic. There's two types of numismatic coins. One is what we call condition rarities. A coin that is just really rare because it's so darn nice. And then there's coins that had low mintages to begin with. They're scarce to begin with. Collectors can never find them. They're hard to find. There's just enough out of them out there to barely keep the market alive. But they keep growing up because they're going up in value because they're never enough. We always recommend mintage rarities, never condition rarities. Condition rarities, the problem is if a coin's really nice, And you want to go to an extreme is all this I've mentioned recently, all this MS-70 stuff they do on modern stuff. Over time, they just find more and more and more and more of those coins nice. And over time, you're going to have more an increase in population of that condition. When a coin's rare to begin with, it's rare to begin with. And then we look for value. You know, there are coins that, you know, are too much for their rarity, and there's coins that are far too little for their rarity. When we build a portfolio, bullion is the base. We think of it as a pyramid. It's gold and silver based heavily. And inside that bullion base, you will include a survival portfolio. If all hell breaks loose, excuse me, you'll have exactly what you need to barter and trade with and do what you need to do there, all the way down to the minuscule fractions, little 10th-ounce gold and small pieces of silver, even old silver dimes that, you know, have like a dollar's and something worth of silver in them. And then we'll go all the way up from there. Then we do the semi-numismatic, as I discussed, in a smaller portion. And then the numismatic is maybe 10 or 15% of the top of the portfolio. On the other hand, when you do 401ks and IRAs, stuff that goes into a holding into our trust, it gets held in the trust, they're more limited in what's allowed in there, mainly, sadly, just because it makes it easier for them to tax when it comes out. They don't want to have to think about it. They don't want any question on its value when it comes out. But if you do have IRAs and 401ks, you know, I keep saying, summer's the low point of the year, always. This is the time when metals hit rock bottom for the year. Every year, July, maybe into August, barely. But a lot of times they're heating up pretty good by August. This is just the time. If you've procrastinated, waited, come and see us. I don't care what you have. I can tell you hands down, if you have an annuity, folks, get out. They're an absolute heat case. They're a deception. Come and see us. We'll help you get out. You'll literally find out how big the commission was on it. When you try to cash out an annuity, you go through a extremely difficult time with everybody in the company that sells the annuity trying to stop you, because their profit margins are the highest profit margin on a financial vehicle in the world, actually. Up to 35% of people's annuity money goes to pay commissions to salesmen. I mean, that's not an investment. Can you imagine if I said, hey, invest with me. Give me $10,000. Now, I'm going to take $3,500 and you're only going to have $6,500. This is where the gold lines of the world, you know, this stuff goes on out there. I won't get too specific, but let's just, you know, keep it simple, folks. We make a small percentage, a couple percentage points, roughly 2 to 4. And our products work. They sell well. They move well. They preserve capital well. We are dedicated to try to be so fair. And without getting into more detail, I'll just leave it at that. It's important to understand. The hard assets, of course, I didn't get to that again. The hard assets, folks, have been around as long as man has been on this earth. They have never failed or let anybody down. Okay, they may fluctuate. You can get them stolen. Sorry to break the news to you. I've heard people say, well, I don't want that. Someone could steal it. Oh, great. Put your money in an account and ship it off by wire to wherever and feel comfortable with that. Really? I mean, you've got to just stop, folks, sometimes and meditate on the insanity of what they've done to our thinking process. Do you think Jesus would do that? I don't think so. So we'll just leave it at that. We're short on time. Again, my specialty. But, you know, you can call Coins Plus 444-0044, toll-free 877-TAP-COIN, or through the website at coinsplus.com. We have all the previously recorded radio shows available on our website. You're welcome to go listen. But, folks, don't delay. Don't procrastinate. It's a bad thing. Take care. God bless. And we'll see you Friday. Bye-bye.